Isaac Newton spent as much time decoding the Bible, looking for concealed messages in the dimensions of the of Noah's Ark or the Temple of Solomon or the Tower of Babel, as he ever did studying gravity or light. And he thought that his biblical work was at least as important as his scientific work. Here he is, for instance, trying to match up the language in the book of Revelation with events in world history. The fourth beast was exceeding dreadful and terrible and had great iron teeth. This is Newton quoting Revelation. And devoured and brake in pieces and stamped the residue with his feet. And this, Newton tells us, this was the Roman Empire. To us, it sounds crazy, but that's not the point. The point is that Newton and all his peers believed that the universe was a cosmic code, and their task was to break that code. In the 1660s, Newton and all his fellow scientists were poring over their Bibles, and what they saw terrified them. The Day of Judgment, everyone knew, was a subject of great interest in the Bible. But the point for these scientists was that the Day of Judgment was not just something that was going to happen at some indefinite time. It was going to happen soon, very soon. I should say that one reason that they found this so plausible was that nobody at the time believed in the idea of progress. The very scientists whose work was about to transform the world didn't believe in it. What everyone believed was that the world had been falling apart ever since Adam and Eve, and lately that fall had begun to speed up. So Newton and his peers had done all kinds of calculations based on various passages in the Bible to calculate just how near the end was, and they all came up with a date of around 1660. And this fear was widespread. It wasn't just a matter of a handful of intellectuals calculating things, but common belief. The Bible talked about the signs that would foreshadow the last days. War and misery on earth and chaos in the heavens. And if you looked around, in Europe you had the 30 Years' War in what would be Germany. 30 years, the name draws away the significance. But the plague is raging in Europe, devastating one city after another. In England, there have come to be all sorts of reports of strange, monstrous births. Women are giving birth to these half-human monsters, which everyone knows is a sign that God has lost his patience with his creation. And then, in the fall of 1664, a comet appeared overhead. This was disastrous, literally disastrous. The word disaster, the dis part of the word, is the same root as disgrace, disfavor. An aster is from astrum, the Latin for star or comet. There couldn't be a worse sign. A comet overhead, what was a message like a lightning bolt, except longer lasting. These comets were supposedly kindled by God's red-hot anger. What was particularly bad about this comet in 1664 is it stayed overhead night after night, week after week. The common people panic. Scientists chime in by pointing out just how dire this is. Then finally, the comet disappears. And in March 1665, 3 months later, a second comet appears. A month after that, a young English bureaucrat named Samuel Pepys sits down to write in his diary. He writes about the day's events. He writes about dinner, which was good, and about the state of his finances, which was cheery. And then he adds a somber note at the end. Great fears of the sickness here in the city. God preserve us all. The sickness was bubonic plague, the Black Death. For 1,000 years it had raged up and then died down. London had been spared for about 50 years, but now it jumped the channel from Europe. Pepys kept a record. In June in London, about 100 deaths a week. In July, 1,000. By the end of August, 6,000 deaths a week. Whole families died overnight. Priests in perfect health went to comfort dying men and died next to them. Doctors keeled over next to their patients. There were too many deaths for individual burials. Death carts rattled along empty streets in search of bodies. Mournful cries of "Bring out your dead" rang out. The English recalled the words of King Edward III, eyewitness to an earlier epidemic. A just God now visits the sons of men and lashes the world. By the time it ended, late in 1665, plague had killed about one-fifth of the people in London, 100,000 people dead. Now it's 1666. This is an especially ominous year because of the 666 in the date. And in 1666, another calamity, the Great Fire of London. It burns out of control for 4 days. 100,000 people are left homeless. Scores of churches burned down. Iron bars in prison cells melted. The stunned survivors stumbled through the ruins, gazed about their city, where a great city had stood just days before, one eyewitness lamented. There is nothing to be seen but heaps of stones. And so, you could hardly blame England's trembling citizens for thinking that the end of the world was nigh. But we now know that they had the story exactly backwards. The 1660s didn't mark the end of time, but the beginning of the modern age. In the midst of this chaos and calamity, a handful of geniuses looked out and saw perfect order. Looked at in the right way, they said, the universe was not just orderly, but it was a machine, a perfect machine, an intricate clockwork. As I say, all this came to a head around 1660. That year, a group of men gathered in a London mansion, shoved their way into a big room with a fireplace and a wooden table and some wooden benches. This was a grab bag collection of geniuses and eccentrics. Often the genius and the eccentric was the same person. A group with a very grand name. This was the Royal Society, their first meeting. Today they're renowned as the world's oldest scientific organization. But at its beginning, much more akin to a group meeting of very smart, very rowdy Cub Scouts. The men of the Royal Society were perpetually mixing things together and throwing them into the fire in the hope that it would explode. One of the leaders of the group, Robert Hooke, who was a small, twisted, bad-tempered, brilliant man who could build anything, had figured out a way that you could pump the air out of a bell jar. And this was an enormous hit. The Royal Society was perpetually putting first candles, but then much more fun, mice and chickens and snakes and anything they could grab into the bell jar and pumping out the air to see what happened. And to their delight and bewilderment, what happened is that whatever was in keeled over. But some of the things took a long time to die and some died right away. What the mysterious ingredient in air was that the creatures needed to live, and why some needed more of it than others, nobody knew. But the bell jar was a guaranteed crowd pleaser. At one point, Hooke figured out a way to make a giant one so big that he could climb in himself. So he climbs in and gives the order to pump out the air, but the bell jar had malfunctioned before he could kill himself, but he did manage to stumble out dizzy and deaf, which everybody took to be the next best thing. All the experiments had that anything goes quality. One day, everyone gathered around the table to test an age-old belief that if you took powdered unicorn's horn and spread it in a circle and then put a spider down in the middle of the circle, he wouldn't be able to escape. The point is that brilliant ideas and crackpot ideas were all mixed together. A meeting might start with a talk about spiders and unicorns and end up with a talk on astronomy by Christopher Wren. There's a couple of things to notice here. One is that nothing was settled. This was an era when almost any question you could ask was new and bewildering. Why does fire burn? Why do rocks fall? Nobody knew. We tend to underestimate just how revolutionary the Royal Society's approach to questions like that was. The Society took as its motto a Latin phrase that meant roughly, don't take anyone's word for it, which to us sounds like common sense. But this was not just a radical idea, but a bizarre one at the time. Of course you took someone's word for it. If you wanted to find out something, the way you did that was to look to see what the expert said. To say that you should look for yourself would be as if someone was taking a sea voyage and you told him that it would be smart if he grabbed the ship's wheel from the captain and steered for himself. For us, new is a word of praise, and new and improved go together. But in the 1600s, new meant dubious and untested. thinkers in the 1600s felt about new ideas the way we would feel about a parking place right in front of a restaurant that you wanted to go to. If it was that obvious, it couldn't be legal. There had to be trouble. Worse than that, to look for yourself and to think for yourself was to verge on heresy. The mark of a devout person was to take things on faith, literally on faith. For 1,000 years, the church had said so explicitly. The reason God was called Almighty was that he could do things that seemed impossible. So curiosity and skepticism weren't virtues. They were signs of bad character. One theologian at the time delivered a furious condemnation of these impossible-to-please scientists. If the wisest men in the world tell them that they see it, if Christ and his apostles tell them that they see it, if God himself tells them that he sees it, yet all this does not satisfy them unless they may see it themselves. One reason that scientists of the day were willing to face up to such attacks was that they had seen something astonishing. They'd caught on to God's true nature. Not only was God the creator, but he was a creator of a particular sort. God was a mathematician. This was new. The Greeks had honored mathematics above all other fields, all other forms of knowledge, because it was the mathematical truths were indisputable and eternal. The angles of a triangle add up to 180 degrees, and they did 1,000 years ago, and they will 1,000 years in the future. No other knowledge had that certainty. Besides that, the Greeks found mathematics beautiful. Not useful, beautiful. To call an idea useful in a society where manual labor was the domain of slaves would have been to sully it. It would be like praising a sculptor by saying that it would also make a good doorstop. So this had nothing to do with religion. The Greek gods weren't mathematicians. Zeus was too busy chasing after Hera to bother with geometry. But when the scientists of the 1600s looked around them, they found Euclid's geometry turning up in places where no one had ever expected it to be. If you shoot an arrow in the sky or throw a rock, the path it makes is a parabola. If you trace the path of a planet around the sun, it travels in an ellipse. Those were Euclid's shapes, and they turned up in places that neither Euclid or anyone else had ever thought they could be. It was as if someone had flung a gigantic diagram from a geometry textbook across the heavens. Newton and his peers looked at those discoveries, and they made a giant leap. They said, in some of its aspects, nature follows mathematical laws. Therefore, in all of its aspects, nature follows mathematical laws. Newton and Galileo and the others found a handful of golden threads, and they inferred the existence of an entire golden tapestry. The astonishing fact is that that unfounded faith, that presumptuous belief about what God was up to, would in time transform the world. Let's stop there. Thanks.
The two microphones to ask your question.
If there are questions, that